My name is Bob Darrow, and I'm an alcoholic. Sober since October 31st, 1978, through the program and Fellowship Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to thank Bobby for picking me up at the airport yesterday. It was a kind of a nostalgic experience. He couldn't find his car. Yeah. It's brought back floods of memories. Oh, there he is, looking properly ashamed of himself. And he was very gracious to drive, went way out of his way to come get me down at National Airport, drove up here. I've always impressed by the selfless enthusiasm of Alcoholics Anonymous members as they just throw themselves aside to serve something here, and you see that a lot here in AA, which in normal society probably wouldn't be that big of a deal, but we're degenerately selfish people. I mean, in here it's a big deal. It's a real big deal. I am excited to talk about this, the beginning of the fourth step. I want you to know I don't think anything has changed me or resulted in facilitated more change in me than the fourth step as it was outlined in the big book. And yet, it took me a while. I had to suffer from untreated alcoholism in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous sober for several years before I actually did this. And one of the problems that I faced is, you know, I took a third step pretty new and towards the end of my first year, I suppose, and I was under a lot, seemingly I was under a lot of pressure to do a fourth step. And when I say that, I'd go to meetings and it would seem like my sponsor had set it up so the fourth step would be the subject or something. And I'd go to meetings he wouldn't even know I was going to, and it would be the subject. And I just got tired of being the guy who would have to say, well, I haven't actually done, you know, and, oh, man. So I did what so many of us here do. I turned to the big book as instructed. The guy said, just do what it says in the book. Turn to the book. I don't follow directions well. It's just something about me. If they don't agree with my preconceived notion of what it should say, I don't do it. And there's nothing in this fourth step in the book that makes sense to me. I don't know who Mrs. Jones is and Mr. Brown. Stop it. So I did what a lot of us do. I found that one little bit in the next chapter. It says we told someone our whole life story, so I wrote a biography, you know, a biography of depravity, you know, and 40 pages of just shameful, pathetic. Not only didn't I get relief, I wanted to shoot myself by the time I was done. I remember just grueling through this with a guy for 8 hours, you know, just 8 hours of the most narcissistic crap you could ever imagine. I mean, oh, and there was a little, I guess I got a little bit of relief because I had a couple really deep, dark secrets that I'd never shared with anyone, and I got them out in the open, and that's not all bad. But nothing except for that little bit of relief really changed in me. I didn't have what the book says is a fact-finding and a fact-facing experience. I didn't discover any truth about me. There was nothing on there I didn't already know. See, I thought it was like confession, because I was a Catholic. I thought that's what it was about, right? Oh, it's so much more than that. And then I still found myself struggling with depression and overwhelming type A personality worry and just bad stuff. getting in beefs with people in AA and alienating and pushing people away, and I don't mean to. And I went through 9 jobs in 4 years. Now that speaks volumes of untreated alcoholism right there. And I tried in that 4 year period, I went back and did another 4-step following a book that was popular. It was odd. There was a period in AA for probably 2 decades where it became popular to try to work the steps out of the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions book, which is a fantastic book, a book I use all the time. But it's not a set of directions, per se, of how to... It's essays from people who had done it, talking about what their experience is, doing it, what they discovered, etc. It's a wonderful book. There's more identification in there, I found, in some of those steps than anywhere else. And then after a few years of suffering from alcoholism, I having this battle with my ego. See, I started to know something. I went to a 2 things had happened to me. I went to a Joe and Charlie workshop, and I'm listening to them talk about the 4-step. I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, that's not what I did. That's not what I did. But my ego does not want to cop to that. Because I've been going to meetings and just lording over everybody how I've done a 4-step. I've been waving the banner of I'm one of the guys on that side of the line. That I'm not with you people who haven't done it. I'm on that side of the line. And I don't want to go, or I don't want to have to say, well, maybe I really didn't do it. And maybe nothing's changed, except that I was suffering a lot from alcoholism. In that period of time, I was very self-righteous. You know, I'd take the traditions, I'd take the steps, I'd take everything I learned in AA and beat people over the head with it. Grandizing myself, I became the guy that just seemed to want to be the center of attention and never could ever get enough of it. I was on every committee there was to be on. I went to a lot of meetings. I was actually, in a sense, I didn't know it, but I think I was trying to outrun my alcoholism by 15 meetings a week, a lot of 12-step work. And all of that's good. Believe me, it is all good. It probably saved my life. It kept me in a safe environment till I could eventually hit a bottom sober with this stuff and go back and start doing this process in the book. It changed me so dramatically. What had happened to me is not unusual. Dr. Harry Thiebaud talks about the amazing recuperative powers of the alcoholic ego. I think a lot of us, like me, we get here and we have been surrendered by the bottle. We're beaten to our knees. And then we come into Alcoholics Anonymous and get a little bit of relief, and the ego just kind of, it creeps back in. Only I don't know it. I don't know it. And I became the guy who was very judgmental. I mean, I couldn't even listen in meetings anymore because I can't stop picking you apart. You know, I just sit in meetings and somebody would be sharing, I'd go, is that a toupee? are those real? You know, oh my God, this guy sounds like a Hallmark card in a recovery bookstore. You know, I just pick. And I don't know that what is happening is I'm playing God. I've created a separation between me and you. My ego is in full bloom. But you don't know it when you think you're right. And Thiebaud says we must have this ego reduction at depth. We must... at depth. So it's probably a newcomer. I can't even get the right door into AA. This too. So I started. And one of the great things that happened to me as a result of the Joe and Charlie is I was sponsoring a guy and he wanted to do a 4-step and he asked me for help. And I actually sat with him in this book. and I went through it paragraph by paragraph with him, and we tried to figure out what's it saying here. And it was such an amazing experience because I've read this part of the book over and over and over again for me and couldn't see much. But when I was reading it for him, the veil of self was lifted because I was trying to look at it to benefit him. And I could see stuff in the book when I was doing it for him that I couldn't see when I was doing it for me. The Hindus have a saying that the student doesn't learn the lesson until he becomes the teacher. And I learned how to do a fourth step out of the book by helping a guy do a fourth step out of the book. And we didn't have any big book technicians in those days. We didn't have any of that. We just struggled with this stuff. And so what I did is I started to do what it said in the resentment section. It starts off saying resentment's the number one offender. I would have guessed guilt should have been when I got sober. But, you know, actually, guilt is a very small part of the fear inventory. Resentments seem to be forever. I had case files built on people from the time as far back as I can remember. And then every time I'd see them, I'd add a page. Because what happens if you have the ego that I got, when you get a resentment, what do you got? You got a judgment. And when you get that, when you lock in that judgment, that person in your mind will never and can never change. You freeze frame them in that position. 30 years later, they're the same person. They're the same. Now, in the last 30 years, they could have helped the poor. They could have done all kinds of wonderful things. And even when it's stuck in your face how much they've changed, you go, "Yeah, they're just showing off." The need to be right about judgments is overwhelming. When I did my first, we'll get into this later. So what did I do? I listed the resentments. I've discovered in working with guys over the years that there's a lot of guys that don't want to even admit to themselves they have resentments. It's that macho thing. I don't want to admit that anybody can hurt my feelings. I don't want to admit you can get to me. I was with a guy about 10 years ago who was 23 years sober with the benefit of step none, and he was insane. And he hadn't had a drink, but he was going to kill himself. He was going to shoot himself in the head sober. And the obsession to drink returned, and that scared him. He didn't care the fact he was going to kill himself. He just didn't want to, after he's dead, everybody realize he didn't have 23 years. I understand that. I don't care about dying. I just want to look good after I'm dead. And so we started this process, and we got to the resentment section. I said to him, I said, "I want you to write a resentment list." And this is an old, blustery ex-Navy chief, right? One of those kinds of guys talking with a deep, gravelly voice. And he goes, "Resentments? Oh, I don't have any resentments. I just let go of it." Well, this guy's got so much torque inside of him, he hasn't let go of much. I mean, you could watch him walk across a parking lot from 100 yards and know he's uptight about a lot of stuff just from his body language. I said, "You don't have any resentments?" "Nah, just let it go." So what I said to him next was brilliant. It wasn't me. I think it was through me. Bob, that's one of the things Bob says all the time I just love. We're never the well, but sometimes we get to be the pipe. And I said to Jerry, I said, "Okay, listen, let's do something different. Let's make a list of people you feel smugly superior to." He gets this look on his face like, "Oh, that's going to be a long list." I start making this list of people, the idiots, the people that are wrong, the people that have hurt me, the people that are out of line, the stupid people. It's a long list. It's a long list. The stupid people. Put the people down on your list that if there were any justice in the world, they would owe you an amends. They would owe the world an amends. Put them down. Put them all down. And then what's the next thing I do after I go through back through my whole life and I make this list of all the people I've had judgments about? I list the cause. And if you want to look in the, if you want to follow in the book, you can. I don't want to make this an academic thing, but on page 65 there's three columns. It's the first three things of six things the book asked me to do in the resentment section. Six things. First thing is who, making the list. The second thing is why. Why was I angry? Why was I hurt? Why? The cause. A little bullet points. I don't believe in doing a lot of writing at this point because it's just natural for me to get into a dissertation that is justifying, right? I'm one of those kind of guys that if I get a resentment, if you hurt my feelings, I just can't go to my sponsor and just say exactly what happens. I have to tell a story about it, right? So by the time I'm explaining it, he hates the guy too. You know what I mean? Right. So, okay. You get that, right? We all get that, right? Okay. So let's not do that. Let's just little bullet points. And then the third thing, column number three on page 65, we're looking for what in self had been affected. Because in the beginning it says we're looking for the manifestations, the resurgence of self that had been threatened. What has been unsurrendered here that's gotten hit? And it gives you a list of choices. And you know how you know it's aspects of self? Change the pronoun. And I have the guys I sponsor sometimes go through the book and change the pronouns from the third person to the first person. And when you change it to the first person, it says, in most cases we found that it was my self-esteem, my pocketbook, my ambitions, which is another way of saying my way, my personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore, we were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name are my injuries. And then it says the things that had been interfered with, and then it says effects. And the book uses five words to describe perspectives of looking for the aspects of self that we're going to list in the third column. And I think there's some brilliance in that. Because I've noticed in my own experience, when I look at a certain resentment and I try to ask myself what had been affected, sometimes I don't see it. So I go to what had been threatened, and it's getting a little clearer. And then what had been injured, okay, what had been interfered with, and all of a sudden it's the veil lifts, and oh, me getting my way, my ambitions had been interfered with. And each one of those, it's almost like circling a building, those five terms. Each one gives you a little different perspective until you go, boing, that's it. And I found that in most cases, especially in deep-seated resentments, most of these were affected or threatened or hurt. So I got these three columns. And if that's all you do, in my experience, you'll get sicker. Because you've just laid out you just documented your victimization at depth. But this is absolutely necessary to climb out of the trap, to dismantle the ego. I can't think of a greater exercise in doing this. Remember at the very beginning when we're coming out of the third step, it says something very interesting. It says that this third step is not the end all, even though it's a vital and crucial step, that in and of itself it's not going to get you anywhere. It's going to have very little permanent effect unless followed by an effort to be rid of the things that are blocking me. See, the ego, you don't even know if you're like me that you're blocked. But what would happen to me in those years is I would get up in the morning with wonderful, heartfelt intentions to do God's will. And I would get on my knees and I would reiterate the third step prayer every single morning. and get up off my knees and immediately go up into the control center where I run the frickin' universe. And it says we're blocked. I can't stop it. Because I'm ego-dominant. I'm self, me, dominant. Now, I dress it up. I'm the guy talks about earlier in the book that the actor sometimes is quite virtuous. He's kind, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I dress it up. Because even though I don't want to... There's an art form to playing God and looking humble at the same time. I mean, it's something we refine here at great depth. I mean, it's because you learn little tricks in here. The ego is smart. Go to a meeting sometime where the subject is step 7 or the subject is humility. So what's the ego do? And hear somebody go, well, if you think you're humble, you're not. And then they call on you. Well, I don't have any humility at all. And you know, by saying that, everybody will think you're very humble. I mean, it's trickster. It's a great trickster. It's clever. So I have to get rid of the things that are blocking me, and I have to dismantle the judgment machine that is of my ego to have this, what Thiebaud calls ego reduction at depth. And so what happens is I make the first 3 columns, and the book says went back through our lives, and it spends a whole page hammering 7 times a point that this crap's going to kill you. It's going to kill you. You're dying here, aren't you? You're not drinking. You look like you need one, Bob. I had somebody in that period of time come up to me at the TIE Club in Vegas after a meeting and accuse me of having my sense of humor surgically removed. I mean, I was... There's happy, joyous, and free, and there's Bob. You know, I mean, it was like, it's kind of like that, you know? I was a mope. I was a self-righteous mope. Angry, self-righteous, depressive mope. And I didn't mean to be, and I couldn't help it. Alcoholism has the best of me. It always does, unfortunately, without grace in my life. And so I'm trying to move me out. I'm trying to move me out. I love Ralph says it. It's wonderful. This is about shrinking Bob and growing God. And I don't have to grow God. It's a push-pull. All I got to do is reduce me. God just Chuck Chamberlain used to say, God deplores a vacuum. You just have to empty you out. God comes in. You don't have to even look for him. It's automatic. Just empty you out. And that's what I'm trying to do in this process. Empty me out of all my judgments. And so if you can buy the proposition that these resentments own you, they keep you locked up in here in the control center. They keep you disconnected from people. If you've bought all the scenarios of the actor who wants to run the whole show in the book, you get that. You get that you're the producer of confusion, even with good intentions. If you get that, and you get that this stuff's killing you, then maybe you're at the place that it talks about 3/4 of the way down the page and says we're prepared to look at these from an entirely different angle. Clancy talks about alcoholism being a disease of perception. In our book, it refers to the root is self-centeredness. I'm begging God in the 3rd step to relieve me of the bondage of self. So the book is asking me to look at all of these from an entirely different angle. Now, if my angle is one of judgment, almost as if I'm the prosecuting attorney, an angle of self looking at the people in this situation, then what would be an entirely different angle? Maybe instead of being the prosecutor, I would get up off the prosecutor's table and I'd walk across the courtroom. And I would sit down in the defense table and I would start pleading this case and telling the story from their point of view, from an other-centered rather than self-centered point of view. And I don't know anything about any of your cases, but I'll bet you one thing. I bet you in the story you've told yourself about the person you resent, I bet you the story they tell about what happened between you and them is different than the story you tell. And the ego goes, yeah, but they're wrong. Yeah. Look, check your track record out. What are the chances? I mean, you know, come on. So I'm going to look at it from their point of view and to put myself in their shoes. And the book starts to walk me through this process. There's a line here that implies something that is more than an implication. It seems to be a consistent intermittent reality through all my resentments. It says that the wrongdoings others fancied or real have the power to actually kill. Fancied, that which means that I may have told this story in my head so much and so often that it doesn't even have anything to do with reality anymore. I may have blown up what you did to such horrific proportions and minimized anything I had to do with the situation to such a point where the story I'm telling myself 20 years later doesn't even match reality anymore. And I don't even know I do that. You don't go from the, it's black and white to blue and green overnight. It's a slow shift as you tweak the story in your head, if you're like me, until it's over here. And so I'm trying to look at the truth. I'm trying to awaken. I'm trying to the truth, to lift the veil so I can see. Isn't it odd that by the time most of us get here, we have lived a life of conflict and separation? I've been fired by many employers. I've lost jobs. I've had broken relationships. I've had friends turn on me. I've had my family turn on me. And I'm baffled because I don't see why these people are treating a nice guy like me like this. And the reason I feel baffled is if I can't see me the way you saw me. If I could see me the way you saw me, I'd know exactly why they fired me. I'd know exactly why she left me. I'd know exactly why those guys are no longer my friends. But I can't see me the way you see me. I can't see reality. And that's not uncommon in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a book, it's as Bill sees it, Al-Anon's more legit. They have as Lois remembers. I think theirs is a little more realistic. You want to have a funny experience? Get with one of your siblings and start talking about your childhood. In about 20 minutes, you'll think they were raised in a different house. I mean, my sister goes on about the love and her family and all that stuff, how wonderful it was. And as she says that, she tells stories about it. I can remember bits and pieces of it, sort of. But it wasn't my interpretation of it at all. I just didn't look at it that way. My sister could feel the love in my household. I was so internally focused and narcissistically self-involved and disassociated from life that I couldn't feel it. I could see it peering out from deep within me. And I could see the evidence of it. But I couldn't feel it. My sister could feel it because she was actually in the home. I was in another one up here somewhere. So, I have to be prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle. Some of these resentments may be fancied. Am I willing to entertain the proposition that maybe my memory of these cases I've built are that they may not be fact? Am I willing to concede that's the possibility of that? And then it says, we saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? A lot of us drink as a result of them. We drink, we leave Alcoholics Anonymous. We leave our abstinence in a flurry of self-righteousness. A lot of us leave like that. Or a lot of us just edge ourselves out of Alcoholics Anonymous through resentments that I don't even know are resentments. I bet you I'm not the only one that's ever done that. You just start making little judgments towards people in AA. Until after you do that long enough, there's nobody you'll listen to except you. Right? Because you're the only smart guy left. So we saw that these must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. Well, that's awful. I mean, it spends a whole page saying, oh, Bob, this is going to kill you. It's going to destroy you. It's going to cut you off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol is returned. You're going to drink. You're going to die. It's going to be horrible. It's terrible, awful. And by the way, you can't do anything about it anyway. Why? You can't wish it away any more than alcohol. And you can't. And I did this horrible thing that a lot of us do in AA, and I don't even know I'm doing it. This is what the ego does, is that I come into AA and the ego learns. I learn resentments, bad resentments. Shouldn't have resentments. You're not a good AA member if you have resentments. So I'm just never going to have any again. That's not how you get free. That's how you build an ulcer. Didn't bother me. I'm just going to go home and plot your death. Or what happens often to me, I'm a depressive guy, so I turn it inward. And I just start beating myself up, and I just start digging the abyss that I sink into as I turn it into myself. And I'm very good at that. I have that to an art form. And so what do? I'm sitting with this guy. I have never done the fourth step out of the book, and I'm helping him do it. We spend the whole page on this, it's going to kill you stuff. And he looks, and he says, we can't wish it away more alcohol. And the guy looks at me, and he says, crap. What do? And I'm looking at him. I got nothing here. I don't know. I got nothing. I don't know. And I look at the book, and the next four words, it says, this was our course. And I go, oh, this was our course. Right here. I'm sure I tried to make it look like I knew that all along. And it says, this was our course. And this is the line that changed my life. This is the line that changed my perception. This is the line from it all understanding and forgiveness came into my life. This is the line that when implemented as a realization in the place it talks about in step one, our innermost self, all the separation between me and you started to dissolve away, even though my ego would create more as time goes on. This was our course, and it's asking me to make a realization. And a realization is not just kind of, can you see it intellectually? This, I believe, is in the place we start this process in chapter 3, our innermost selves. That I somehow must connect the dots within me and make something real that has never, ever been real for me. And what is that? Well, it says we must realize that the people who wronged me were perhaps spiritually sick. Yeah, and they're idiots too. I mean, I get that. But see, that's the ego thinking of looking at a well person looking down on a sick person. That's not what they're talking about. And they clarified in the next line. It says, though I did not like their symptoms. What symptoms? Column number two, all the causes, everything they did. And objectively, if that guy would have been right with himself and right with God, he wouldn't have done what was in column number two, just as I wouldn't have done all the things that I did that hurt a lot of people if I'd have been out of myself, free, present in God's world, and right with me and right with God. I wouldn't have done the things that were on my eight-step list. Except I was disconnected. I had this spiritual malady, which is separation through the ego. Didn't know it. So that though I did not like the symptoms, column two, and the way they disturbed me, how did they do that? Column number three, pocketbook, ambitions, pride, etc., etc. Though I did not like the symptoms, column number two, and the way they disturbed me, column number three, and then here's the deal. I'm supposed to realize that they, or this person, like myself, was sick too. This is not a well person looking pathetically down on a sick person. This is a sick person looking right across the table at another sick person. The best example of this I've ever seen was in the movie Bucket List. There's a scene in there where Morgan Freeman and Jack Nicholson have both been diagnosed as terminally ill with cancer, and that's a brutal deal. And they're both being given a last-ditch, brutal chemotherapy. And what's happening is they're not being given the chemotherapy on the same day. They're alternating. It's a couple days apart. So what happens is that they're never brutalized and extremely sick from the chemo the same way at the same time. And there's a scene in there after they've been into this for a while, this chemo, where the one guy is just horribly sick from this chemo, and he's irritable, and he's trash in the room, and he's a pain in the butt. And the other guy's not looking at him like he's a jerk. He's looking at him with love, understanding, and compassion, because he's seeing past the outward symptoms of what's driving him and seeing right into the guy and knows he gets it. He gets it because it was him 3 days before. He saw the truth. And that's what the book's asking me. This realization is lifting the veil so that I can see myself in you, to see that if I was afraid like you were afraid, if I had been hurt like you were hurt, because hurt people will hurt people. If I had been raised like you were raised, if I had everything going on inside of me that was driving me and tweaking me, that I can see so clearly that I would have done and reacted to that much like you have. You see, there is no smug superiority here. You are me. And it was the first time in my life I ever started. And it's a funny, this. I've sat with hundreds of guys going through this process. And it's always, I always start with the worst resentment, the worst one now. And guys taught me that by letting him, they would hide him in the middle. And you start with the worst one, and when you can get the realization on the worst of them, it's like dominoes. The rest of them just fall. Once you peep the truth, all of a sudden you start seeing it in every single resentment. But getting through the worst one is the hardest. It's the hardest. To see myself in that other person. I'll tell you a little story. Okay, I'm running out of time. About close to 20 years ago, I suppose, I was listening to a fifth step of a guy who came from an alcoholic home. And he had a horrific childhood. It was brutal. His dad was not only a bad drunk, his dad used to beat him until on many occasions he'd end up in the hospital with a broken arm or just all kinds of stuff. He'd have to make up stories about how he fell out of a tree or he wrecked his bicycle, because he never wanted anybody to know what was going on at home. And in those days, child abuse was not a big issue, and that kind of stuff was swept under the table often, and nobody ever suspected. And I'm not talking about a couple incidences. I'm talking about a childhood of abuse. His dad would get so rageful. There were occasions where his dad would be so getting so much trouble through his drinking, he would swear off and for a period of time wouldn't drink, but it wasn't any better because he was an alcoholic without alcohol. So what are you left with is an extreme case of the ick. And I've worked around alcoholics that aren't drinking. I had this one guy, he's now sober 20 years. I used to work with him. I used to want to give him a drink. Because he'd be better when he would have a drink. He'd be just, can I get you a drink? Can I get you something? And his dad would beat him when he was sober and beat him when he was drunk. And he was irritable when he was sober and he was irritable when he was drunk. And he had to create a whole secret childhood. Couldn't let anybody know what was going on. And this is not a resentment that just kind of passed. It owned him. It affected his ability to work and be a team player and for the rest of his life. It affected his relationships, everything. He'd spent about 8 years in therapy trying to get free of it. Never did. Matter of fact, most of the therapists just seemed to vindicate him and reinforce his case about how horrible his dad was and how what an innocent victim he was. And it's very dangerous for us to take a victim stance, no matter how justified it seems. And he could never get free. And here we are, and he's talking about this resentment. And then when he was done, I started walking him through what the process here. I read this little passage out of the 12 by 12 in step 10 where Bill reiterates what he says here pretty much. He talks about as we approach true tolerance and see what real love actually means, it will become more apparent that all people, including ourselves, are emotionally ill as well as frequently wrong. And we'll start to see how all of us are suffering from the pains of growing up. And then I said to him, I read the part, this was our course, and I said to him, I said, you must realize how your father is sick and how your father is like you. And when I said your father is like you, he got really very angry at me. The implication that this monster, that he was like this monster, his reaction was off the charts. He started ranting and raving and raising his voice, and it was actually very frightening to sit there. And I'm one of the, I don't handle stuff like that well. My sponsor would have been nose to nose with him yelling at him, but I'm not that guy. I'm not wired like that. And I just started backing up, and I don't know what to say to him. He's ranting and raving, and when he ran out of gas, I'm just sitting there, and all I can think of is, well, I guess he's not prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle. I mean, I got nothing here, you know? I got nothing. I don't know what to say to him. And Bob uses that line, we're never the well, but we get to be the pipe. And something came out of me next. He just starts reading this other resentment. And I can't even hear him because I got something on me. And I got it on me, I think, because when I sit down to listen to a fifth step, I get quiet, I ask the guy to invite God in, I invite God in, I ask him to make me useful. And I stopped him and I said, I want to go back to another resentment, the one at the beginning. And at first he didn't know what I meant. He thought he wanted to talk more about his dad, and he got a little defensive. And I said, no, not your dad. That woman, remember that woman you lived with all those years that you were hooked up with and the kids and the whole your little white picket fence kind of deal for a while, the one that rejected you? He said, yeah, what of it? There were kids there, weren't there? He said, yeah. I said, I was just wondering if any time in that deal when you were drunk or stoned on drugs or hungover where you might have done anything to hurt those kids. And it looked like the blood ran out of his face. And he hung his head down. And he's like, he's just, I don't know what he's doing. He's like moving his head around. He's hanging his head down. And he lifts his head up. And I remember he's got one tear coming down his one side of his face. And he says in his horrible voice, he says, I'm just like my goddamn father. I said to him after a moment, I said, how did you feel about yourself when you hurt those kids? He said, I couldn't stay drunk enough. I said, you think your dad's might be like you, like that? And he said, I don't know. He says, I've had nothing to do with my father for several years. My sister goes and sees him, and she tells me that he's alone, and he lives in a little trailer in California, and he's very miserable, and I don't know. She says he can't even drink anymore. His liver is so bad, and his pancreas, that his body won't metabolize alcohol. And his sister told him his dad was the most negative, depressed, pathetic person she'd ever known. And at one point I asked him if he thought that could be him at all. And he said to me at one point, he said, maybe without Alcoholics Anonymous, that's a vision of my future. And the last part of there's two other parts. Right after this was our course, there's a prayer. And the prayer is a call for action, as all good prayers are. Alcoholics Anonymous seems to be based on a fundamental that without him, I can't, but without me, he won't. So we're big in AA on action. Demonstrations, action, show, demonstrate, do. It's a very action-oriented program. And this prayer is a call for action. I'm asking God to help me to show this person, to demonstrate, to act towards this person, to show this person the same tolerance, pity, and patience I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. If I get it, you know, if the veil's been lifted, and I get it that this guy can no more help being as sick as he was, as he is, as I could help being as sick as I was when I was as sick as I was. I had a horrific 8-step list. I hurt a lot of people. I broke a lot of hearts. Matter of fact, everybody who ever tried to love me for years seemed to get emotionally battered from it. And honest to God, there was not one person on that 8-step list that I set out consciously to hurt. But I hurt them just the same. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. I hurt a lot of people, but I can't see it. All I can see is me and my stuff and my feelings. I don't even know I'm hurting you because I'm asleep in my own life. And now I'm starting to wake up a little bit, and I'm starting to see this stuff, and so is this guy I'm working with. And the very last thing it says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. And then a little further on it says, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. For 15 years or so, maybe long, I don't know, for a long time here, I used to refer to this with the guys I sponsor, is this is where we look for our part. It never uses that word there. It never says that. And then one day, I'm talking to a guy who just finished his 8-step, and he went to make amends to someone, and it went very badly. And what had happened is he humbled himself to this guy who had done a lot of damage to him and cleaned up his side of the street, and then they ended up getting in a beef because the guy never returned and never made amends for his part, because he was holding on to the idea, I've cleaned up my part, now where's your part? Because if you think in terms of parts, you're thinking, if there's going to be a parts here, okay, here's my part. Well, I mean, you know how we are. Come on. Come on, here's my part. And he's standing there after he took care of his part going, we disregard the other person involved entirely. Now this is a big deal. Because I am a master at hiding my own squirmy, self-serving, self-involved behavior in the shadow of what you do wrong. If I go to work somewhere and the boss takes merchandise home out of a retail store, that's a license to steal for me. Right? I remember I was in a relationship when I was drinking, one of the last relationship I was ever in, when I was drinking, and we broke up repeatedly and got back together again. What a dance of death that was. And during one of the times we broke up, I found out that she dated someone else. So when we got back together, that was like 4 get some free tickets, right? Because I would hide my squirmy, self-serving behavior in the shadow of what you did wrong. Now the book's saying, stop it. Stop that. Stand up. Be a man, for God's sakes. Take the responsibility. Don't hide yourself in what they did wrong. What if you had the perfect parents? What if they were divinely created by God and you couldn't look at what they did wrong and you just had to look at what kind of a son was I? Well, that's not fair. In that light, I owe my dad a lot of money. In that light, I was a horrible son. And what this guy did was the same thing. He started looking at his childhood not behind the veil of all the sickness his dad did and the rage and the beatings, but just simply and truly, what kind of a son was I to this sick man? And what he realized is it was a horrible son. He used his father's guilt for beating him and being such a terrible dad to borrow thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars from his father and never paid back a nickel because his dad didn't deserve it. He gossiped about his dad and lied about his dad, and he turned most of the family and friends of the family against his father, and he grandized himself and pumped himself up as being superior as he tore his dad down. Until at the end, no one would have anything to do with his father except the one sister who kept going over there. And he went to make amends to his father, and he told me afterwards, he said he was scared when he went there to the trailer. I said, what were you scared of? He said, the monster. And he knocked on the door, and the monster didn't appear. What appeared was this little old man. This little old man that was dying, that was sick, that had mild tremors, that was very depressed. And he looked in his father's eyes and he told me he saw himself. And he took the money that he had taken from his father over the years and he used it to take care of his dad. And he started going over there. And his dad, through the love of his son, was able to redeem himself and make amends and tell him how sorry he was for being the way he was. And his son was able to forgive him. Why? Because he understood. He got it. That's me. That's me. And I think this is where some of us who have lived in the isolation and separation of alcoholism are restored to community, is that as I change my perception, it is my judgments and my ego that keeps God out and keeps you out too. There is no view of spirituality that I'm aware of that where I can be close to God like this and still be separate from his children. Matter of fact, most of what we do in AA is I grow closer to God by removing the separation between me and you. Which makes perfect sense, really. If you had a neighbor down the street and you just kept hurting his kids and talking bad about his kids, he may invite you into his house, but you're not going to feel very welcome there if you've been secretly bashing his children. And so I am trying to make myself worthy for my father's house. I think this is a homecoming. I think this is where I discard enough of Bob to find God and find you. And when I find you, I seem to find God. I think that maybe Einstein was right when he said the great illusion of mankind was there's more than one of us here. You listen to enough Fifth Steps, and I'll tell you, and I'll say this, and this is very important. You can do a brilliant job on step 4, but you will get more out of listening to step five than you'll ever get from taking step five. I don't know why that is, but I'm telling you it's true in my experience. This is where I start to get restored to community. I've listened to a lot of fifth steps. I got two in the hopper right now that are coming up. If the guy doesn't drink before the dreaded day, I'm sure we'll... they'll be just like the other, how many ever there were. They're never any different. I haven't heard anything different in a fifth step in over 30 years. I mean, I'm always hopeful. I mean, you know, something interesting. A pony, a vibrating lawn rake, chunky peanut butter, Visqueen, oil, something interesting. But it's never that. It's never jumper cables and a pony. It's always pathetic, just lonely, vacant, scared guys just desperately trying to fill their vacancies and make themselves better and get a little bit of relief from them. And they're stepping on the toes of everybody around them in the process until they've burnt their life to the ground. It's always the same. We could do, if you're new and you haven't done a fourth step, we could do the first page for you. Mother, father, siblings, ex. I mean, you know. Oh, I forgot, you're unique. Thanks for listening.